Welcome to Thursday Night Talk, The Race Beat. I'm Lorna Bryant, live from the Kate Buchanan Room at Humboldt State University. This is a two-hour radio event, so if you have a cell phone, please turn your phone off at this time. There will be a couple of ground rules. This is live radio. There are FCC rules. Because of that, please limit your explicit language, not to a minimum, but zero. That won't be allowed on the air. After 9 o'clock, you're on your own. This show will be in two parts. In the first hour, we'll talk about this upcoming presidency. That will occur in 12 hours or so. We will talk about what this presidency, this upcoming administration, means to our community and our country. In the first hour, we'll talk about some of the political or legal aspects. In the second hour, we will talk about the personal aspects, how it will affect us individually, our children, our families, our neighbors. So we will start in the first hour with our guests introducing themselves and giving us a little bit of background information about who you are and why you're here. Jeff?
Hi, I'm Jeff Blank. I'm here representing the local branch of the NAACP. I've been a member since for over 12, 13 years. I was president of the Reno Sparks branch in Nevada. Was the first white president there in its 70-year history. And I've been going, I've attended like seven or eight national conventions. I've presented on the school-to-prison pipeline at the legal convention twice. I'm married to a wonderful woman, Sharon, and we have two black sons.
Good evening, Lorna. My name is Don Peterson. I am the chief of police here at Humboldt State University. I've been in law enforcement for about 32 years, and interestingly, also an NAACP member for the last 15 or so. Worked previously in Florida, and that's where my branch was, and now I'm a proud member of our Eureka branch, and it's a pleasure to be here with you tonight.
Hi, I'm Clark Sugata. I'm a faculty in the sociology department. My focus is in justice studies and critical criminology, and this is my first year here. I'm actually the newest faculty member of our department. I came via Arizona State University from that community, and particularly due to its geography. A lot of my work, of course, has been situated around immigrant communities and marginalized communities. A lot of the coursework that I'm designing now and that I've been brought in to teach here deals with social inequalities, and specifically I'm teaching a course now on police violence and how communities deal with these kinds of issues. So that's kind of my field about, and you know, kind of how I broach things, looking at things from kind of a social justice perspective.
Hello everyone, my name is Tay Triggs, and I actually am the Associate Dean for Student Engagement and Leadership here at HSU. And I've been here in the Humboldt community since 2012. I am a pretty active member in Arcata and Eureka, and I also have a child who is being schooled here in Arcata. I've also had a great time actually studying the shift in membership in supremacist groups for the last 10 to 15 years. I've been in higher ed for 15 years. And came here in HSU, like I said, in 2012, and have been really trying to work with some of the local schools as well in terms of some of the issues that we've faced with kids of color in the local school system. And I hope to continue that work.
Right. Hello. I'm very happy to be here. My first name is Lauren. My last name is Cannon. I teach in the philosophy department, and I've been here for about 10 years. My area of emphasis within philosophy is ethics, particularly applied ethics. I teach a lot of environmental ethics for the last 10 years. Also, a couple years ago, I developed and now teach a course in transgender lives and theory. So I teach that here at HSU in the CRGS, Critical Race, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Department. A lot of my own work in terms of my own philosophy involves questions about ethics, questions about the lives of trans people and how kind of an intersection between trans theory and philosophy of law and how certain legislation affects trans people and trans people who have also other potentially identities that make them more vulnerable than otherwise. Yes, and I'm happy to be here.
Hey, Young. Katja Risling-Baldi. Hi, I'm Katja Risling-Baldi. I am a Hupayuk and Karuk person here from Northern California. I'm also a new assistant professor of Native American Studies here at Humboldt State University. I just was at San Diego State University, actually, as a professor down there of American Indian Studies, so I'm happy to be home. I do a lot of my work on gender, feminist theory and research, and California Indians, and also on contemporary politics, and write a lot on the internet, on blogs and podcasts and things about sort of how contemporary politics affect Native American peoples and how we are a part of a very important national conversation that is happening around environmental justice and violence against women and things that are happening to us on the ground and then are slowly but surely showing that they're going to affect many other people in this world. And I'm very, very happy to be here. This is sort of my first Humboldt County event that I've gotten to do, so I'm excited to see everyone.
Well, thank you all for agreeing to participate. November 8th was a very interesting evening for me. It was the eve of my birthday, and I had great faith in humanity. And then the election results started coming in, and my faith in humanity started to diminish a bit. And then my birthday happened, and I shut down. And then I decided this is a time for empowerment. This is a time to engage and be energized. And that's why we're all here today. I've been asked why or if I chose to have supporters of the upcoming administration here. But that's not what this day is about. It's about the environment being challenged and affected. It's about rights of people of color being challenged and affected. It's about our country being affected. So that's why we're here today. So someone wanted to start with a little story. So let's start with that story right now.
All right. So you're okay. So I did mention to Lorna I had a story, a bit of a fictionalized story that I thought I would start off my piece with, and so I feel very fortunate to start off the whole conversation. So there's, as you know, there's a lot of things going on with regards to the new administration, with the people he's picking for cabinet posts. It's very scary, and so I felt like instead of kind of talking about disturbing legislations, disturbing cabinet picks, I did want to tell a little story. Now, my story is not a happy one, but I want to tell it so that those of us who don't have certain identities maybe can understand what some of the ramifications are of some of the policies that have been acted recently. I mentioned that I write a lot about trans theory and how certain legislation affects trans people and LGBTQ people. You know that in 2015 we had, the right to marry, marriage equality. That's wonderful. Since then, though, in 2016, there were over 150 anti-LGBT, particularly anti-trans laws that were put forward in the country. Three of those stuck. So that seems pretty good. There's many more, though. Now we see that a lot of those same laws are getting ready to be proposed again, and I'm worried that they might have a little bit more chance of being successful given the new Trump administration. So I have a little story. It's a couple minutes. Good? Yes. Okay. So in the story I'm about to tell, This is a story that I wrote. It's fictional, but it's compiled from a lot of personal stories that I've heard people tell. I am telling this story, so if you can't see me, I'm white and middle-aged. I don't look middle-aged, but I look younger than I am. So I'm a white middle-aged guy. I'm also transgender, though, and so that's one of the reasons I'm motivated to do this study and to think about these issues. So I want you to put your mind in this kind of scenario. So I want to, for you to imagine that you're a trans woman who is either fired due to anti-trans discrimination, which is not federally protected. You can be fired because you're trans. In California, we do have laws against that. Or that you're forced to quit your job because you're not allowed to use the restroom that corresponds with your identity, and using the other restroom puts you in too much danger. The laws that have passed on these bathroom laws are generally passed by those who have never met an actual trans person. You know that violence against trans persons is increasing, especially for women like yourself that are persons of color. Statistics show trans women of color, the violence has we've had the most violent year last year of any other year before that. Now you don't have your job and you no longer have health insurance. You can't get affordable health care through the Affordable Care Act, and any health insurance regards your gender identity issue, your gender history, as a pre-existing condition. So they will not accept you for health insurance. Or what happens a lot, particularly it used to happen in California until a few years ago, you would be covered except for anything that was related to your gender. So at one point you have an opportunity for some employment, but it's a swing shift job that has you walking home quite late at night, 3 to 11, right? Maybe you know swing shift. You happen to know that trans women in your area are often stopped by police officers if they are out late at night because they are assumed to be engaged in sex work. A number of sources report that in such cases, the existence of a condom in one's purse is sufficient evidence that one is engaged in illegal activity, right? Not all purses are checked to see if there's a condom in there, but if you look trans and if you're a woman of color, chances are much greater that you're going to be stopped. So you don't take that job because you don't want to deal with the problem of being stopped by police because they think you're a sex worker. This part of increased surveillance is due to the idea of having more law and order by the Trump administration. So you think about the possibility of visiting family outside the U.S., but you can't go because they've increased the requirements for trans persons to get passports that fit their gender marker. That was something that was revised over President Obama and can be changed any moment. It is well known that trans persons often have trouble with TSA agents when we look non-binary or the gender marker on identification is different than what one would expect. So you can't have freedom of movement because you don't have a passport. And again, if you try, you're going to be put yourself in danger. And besides, even the more relaxed standards that got put in place in 2010, you need to have a physician attest that you're undergoing gender transition. You don't have a physician because you can't get health insurance. And so you can't do that either, even if it was either. So you attempt to get a cheaper apartment and go to the Office of Housing and Human Development. But you're not sufficiently helped there. You don't know why, if it's because you're trans, because you're a woman, or because you're a person of color. You remember that the head of this organization, Ben Carson, has had said that trans persons are, quote, abnormal, absurd, or beyond ridiculous. And you wonder if Carson's views are affecting his employees and their policies. So you finally have to move into a different part of town where you can get a much cheaper apartment. This is a part of town which is quite industrial. So you've got industry right next door. In fact, there's a new factory that many people are quite happy about, and you are able to get a job there. So see, people are happy. Trump has brought jobs back to the USA. So that's great. However, later on, you realize that this situation is not working out very well either. After 6 months, you notice that a lot of your fellow workers who've been working there for quite some time, and also the people that live in that industrialized neighborhood, seem to be having problems of a certain kind of respiratory ailment that no one's identifying. You are personally aware that due to a rollback in environmental regulations, the factory where you work has not been careful about its emissions, and it's not uncommon to fudge the numbers on certain reports. Statistics show that people who are vulnerable because of they're economically vulnerable, are much more often being living next to industrial hazards and much more likely to have the ill effects of those hazards. You worry about the industrialized toxins, but you really need the job, and you have nowhere to go. So the question is like, what do you do? What does that person do? So the reason I wanted to tell this story is when we think about the ramifications of the effects of some of the policies, some of what a lot of us here are worried about is people being intentional targeted and hate crimes, particularly for people who are read as Muslim Americans, have skyrocketed 122% in some areas. So there's intentional targeting, but there's other types of negative consequences that a person can get stuck into, like a perfect storm where they can't get out and live a flourishing life. And I tell that story because I want to think about all the different ways that we need to pay attention to what's going on in the country in the next few years and then guard against individuals being in the position of the fictionalized person I just described.
So can you call that a fictional story or a nightmare? Reality.
I mean, it's reality, and I mean, there's stories by people that are in these situations all the time. Now, in California, we trans people do have protections, and that's great. But even in the beginning of the year, there have been 5 more anti-trans bills introduced in different parts of the country, where a person like myself is not able to use the men's room. Right? Or if you do, it's in a whole nother building. I mean, there's just so many odd ramifications. Right now, with regards to those who are in his cabinet, and I don't want to speak too long on this issue, but Ben Carson has said very negative things about trans folks. I mean, and Betsy Voss has supported organizations that say trans people are broken, that trans people should not be teachers. So I guess under that view, I would have to resign my position. We know the history of Jeff Sessions with regards to racism and also being anti-trans. And so I think we have to look far and wide with regards to how we're gonna deal with some of the potential changes.
So you just mentioned Jeff Sessions. He is a cabinet nominee. And Jeff, I'd like you to take that this portion. Let's talk about him just a little bit.
Sure. A colorful character who is trying to be the Attorney General, and the NAACP is actively opposing his nomination, to the point where Cornell Brooks, the president, had a sit-in and got arrested, and to bring attention to Mr. Sessions, he failed to get through the Senate to be appointed as a federal judge. He was a senator, but as a federal judge in the South, he couldn't get through the Senate at that time, mainly at that time because he had made all these racial comments, and basically was overtly racist in several areas. And they're saying that how can that person now be the guy in charge of enforcing all the laws of this country if he feels that, in his case, especially blacks are second-class citizens? So the NAACP is looking at trying to block that because through the legal system, they have a history that goes back, you know, from 1909 to now, over 100 years. The NAACP has tried to use the courts, you know, to make corrections, and there were some great successes that everyone's aware of. You know, Brown v. Board of Education, the Civil Rights Act, you know, these things were great accomplishments, and they're over 50 years old, all right? And if you look at it since then, there were a whole slew of people at that time that were not happy with the Voting Rights Act and all these things. They didn't leave. And the way the NAACP sees it is they're here now and they're trying to flourish again. And so the battles that we thought were won and over are now potentially returning. The NAACP doesn't support individual candidates. They don't come out in that. However, once a candidate has office, they do take note of policies and appointments and become very active. And they say on their national website that, no, they're willing to work with any president. And if you look at it over the past 100 years, there have been some racist presidents that we've had to work with. And that's part of the problem is that you look at it that if you don't teach the true history of what was taking place in the United States based on race, it's easy to fall into the trap that the feeling, and it's not a good feeling now, is, oh my God, there's this overt racism happening now, and the world is coming to an end. Hopefully that's not true. It's not coming to an end, but you know, it is a great leap backwards to a time when there was overt racism. Segregation, lynchings, all these things took place. President Wilson segregated the military. In 1925, there was a 25,000-member Ku Klux Klan march in Washington, D.C., with crowds cheering. So these things happened in America. In other words, it was overtly racist, and that was the norm. And we got away from that. And now with Trump being elected and the appointments he's making, we're looking at, oh, my God, here we go again. And related to this is a focal point that if we have a three-part system, it's supposed to be checks and balances, you know, the executive, the legislative, and judiciary. Well, if you look at the executive and say from a racial standpoint of people of color, not going to get a lot of help there. So the check on that would be, let's go to the legislature. And what's happening in Congress is not very encouraging. And that is something that in 2 years, hopefully can change, because a lot, you know, congressmen are perpetually running for office. And the third is the judiciary, the Supreme Court. Well, the Supreme Court's history, everyone remembers the great decisions they made, and for every one of those, there was over 100 that were totally awful. You know, before, you know, they got rid of segregation, there were hundreds of decisions saying, no, the races should be separated, blacks were inferior. That came from the United States Supreme Court. And when you get to, you know, civil rights and other actions, workers' rights, same thing. And so the NAACP was fighting that for decades and finally made progress. And then, you know, the slippage occurred that if you have it, and nobody really knows why, but, you know, we're going backwards. And this, and what happened now was when President Obama got elected, racism's gone. We've elected a black president. Well, I guess we now know, no, there's always a member or members of our society who are racist. And, you know, and the thing about America is you have a right to be racist, but you don't have a right to make those policies and implement policies that make me suffer because of your beliefs. Right? So with Jeff Sessions, I think it's Jeff, isn't it?
Beauregard.
Beauregard, yes. Sessions. I get my own name here. With Mr. Sessions, it's like they see that as one of the first steps. You know, we don't know what is President Trump, he says a lot. I don't know where he's going because it constantly changes, you know. So, but this appointment, they said no. And I'm sure they're going to come out. I just saw some of the Secretary of Education, and I'm like, it would be funny, but it isn't. You know, another unqualified person going to be in charge of educating everyone in our country. And the problems with education, a man wrote a book in 2005 and said at that time, our schools were now as segregated or more segregated than 1965. Many don't know that. It's like, it is true. It may not be here, but nationwide, that is the case, and for different reasons. It's not because of restrictive housing and so forth. It's based on economics. So it all gets tied together, and I think from the NAACP's point of view, what National's trying to do in here at the local branch is to say, all right, how do we step up? How do we make sure you've got laws, they have to be properly enforced? If they're not there, how do you get them? And who needs the help and assistance, and who needs to stand up?
Absolutely. And we must remind everyone that the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People isn't a black organization. It's the oldest civil rights organization in the country for civil rights, not black rights, not white rights, but for civil rights.
Yeah, I guess for radio, I'm also white. I told my wife I'm middle-aged, and she said, you were middle-aged. and whites, the NAACP cannot function without the support of the white majority. And so we're looking to pull everyone together to go forward and do what's right, because the nation was founded on racism, and there's institutional racism in place, and now that's coming back around, and it's like, how do you deal with that?
Absolutely. Dr. Risling, no, pronounce your last name one more time.
Risling.
Risling Baldy. You grew up in this community. Like you said, you were a Hoopa. Tell me what this upcoming administration means to our native lands here.
I've done quite a lot of thinking about this since the election, and there's sort of a couple of schools of thought. One, which is, we as Native people have a very unique relationship with the federal government. They are tasked with a trust responsibility with us. They are supposed to uphold treaties that they made with us. And we have yet to have an administration that has been stellar at doing those things. So we have always been right on top of over 500 years of survival and resistance against what is sort of a colonial mentality of how a government is supposed to be put together versus the government that they learned from, because they were supposed to have learned from us how democracy was going to work, and what we had created was a way of representing people, and they were like, that's a good idea, we should do that, except we don't want women in there. And then the Indians were like, you need women. Women are very important. In fact, it was, a Cherokee chief who told them, that's why you guys are going to have problems, because you can't even include women in what you do. Like, you're so far behind, right? So we kind of enter into this thing as like, well, we are always ready for what we need to do to make sure that these responsibilities are upheld. And we are always in that position of sort of demonstrating that we are capable enough and smart enough that we are going to hold the federal government responsible for what it's supposed to do. And that our voices are always used as a way to sort of show the way that people sort of always have to resist against what's happening at the federal government level. So there's that line of thought. But when it comes to Trump, you know, I think a lot of Native people see that there's a very personal vendetta that he has against Indians. That I often compare him to Andrew Jackson, actually. Mm. And not even in like a cute way, like they have a lot in common. Like 35% of me kind of thinks he is Andrew Jackson. that maybe Andrew Jackson like made some kind of deal where he gets to still be alive and he's been waiting for the right moment. Because they have these same mentalities. And one thing that people have said about Andrew Jackson is they kind of really glossed over how much Andrew Jackson hated Indians. And I think that with Trump, when you look into his history, people kind of gloss over his real disdain for Indian sovereignty, his real disdain for the role that Indian people play in this country. We have 567 independent sovereign nations that exist in our lands, and we have elected people who probably couldn't even tell you that and have no idea what sovereignty means or what it's about. So I think that what's really good about us is we're not going into any situation having not been through that before. Mm-hmm. But what we see is it's going to take a lot more to educate the right people about how to have that conversation. They often compare us to, they say Indian people are the miner's canary of whatever's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And if you see that they are coming after us very, like, hard because they're trying to prevent us from being able to do something, that's the start of what they're really trying to do. And so what you saw, or if you have been watching, hopefully, at the Dakota Access Pipeline, the way that they treated those water protectors, the things that they're still doing, there's posts now about how they're bringing in military-grade weapons still, even though we're still peacefully protesting, that's what's going to continue to happen at a grander scale for people who are asking for things like clean water. So if you look at what we've been doing, I think you can look to us too for, instead of thinking, what do I do? Start to think, what are all the ways that I can educate and resist what is about to sort of come forward now? Because we've been doing it for a long time, and it makes for some really good stories, so, you know, and some really great community gatherings, so I know that it's possible.
Right. You mentioned the Dakota Access Pipeline. Let's just think about the nominee for, or the candidate for cabinet for EPA. And right now, you have the Army Corps of Engineers. They're battling with the folks who are doing the Dakota Access Pipeline from doing an environmental impact study. That is the bare minimum of what should have been done before this was even proceeded. So can you talk about that impact?
Well, you know, I think that, sadly, that is a continuing method of a lot of the federal government's ways of trying to continue projects that they know are probably not beneficial to the environment. So if you look at what's been happening with the dams here in Northern California, they've been trying to get them to do an environmental impact statement for like 20 years. And this is under an Obama administration. This is under a Bush administration. It's still the same kind of things. What I think that Trump is doing very blatantly is he's nominating people who are not shy about the fact that they are financially invested in the completion of pipelines and in the building of dams. And he's also not shy about his financial investment in those things. He's also said he's not going to divest, and he doesn't think a president can have conflicts of interest, and they're above that. And yet, if you look at what he said before, he's been very clear that his investments are what sort of drive what he's going to do. And his investments right now are in pipelines, and they are in casinos, and those are two things that Native people are very involved with. So what we're seeing is this means that we have to be very, blatant and kind of wear our activism on our sleeve, right? To not be afraid to speak up in every situation about what's going on. When it comes to sort of who they're appointing, it's like we have to be very clear about what that means for other people. If they're not going to do an environmental impact study on their pipeline because that's the investment that they have economically, then understand that they will do that in your community with your water. Like, we're not just protecting our water. We're not saying that this is only for Native people. We're saying this is everybody drinks water. Everybody needs water to live. What we say is water is life. So if we're doing this, it's to sort of help you to understand you have to step up just as much as we do, because this is everybody's deal. And that's what I think is going to happen as he sort of puts these people forward who are very blatant about the way that they're sort of going to avoid all ability to say, I don't have some kind of conflict of interest. They're not shy about it because he's not shy about it. So it's just really calling that out on every occasion.
Yes. If you're just tuning in, this is Thursday Night Talk, The Race Beat. I'm Lorna Bryant, broadcasting live from Humboldt State University's Kate Buchanan Room. The numbers to call if you'd like to join in this conversation are 826-4805, 1-800-640-5911, or via text at 707-492-5478. In a few minutes, we will open the floor up to questions. Jessica Eden is my floor co-host, and she will be passing around a mic and fielding questions from the audience. Now, Clark, I'm going to go to you. You are a visiting professor in the sociology department. There is a department within that in justice studies. Have your students been talking about how this upcoming administration may impact their field or justice in general?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks so much for letting me join the conversation. You know, I think right now there's just a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and that uncertainty sparks, you know, a range of different emotional responses. I really want to thank Lauren for, you know, kind of bringing to light, I was really thinking through as he was telling his story about how sometimes we put an overemphasis on the actual event of violence. Like when something occurs, then we can label it as like that was a violent event. But we miss the fact that the violence is always there. Whether or not it manifests itself is often immaterial. For the person that's experiencing that condition of fear or living in that condition of fear, the violence is always there and is always ongoing. Mm-hmm. And this is something we've talked about in a number of our courses in sociology. One of our, a book I immediately thought of, you know, after the election happened and we kind of got back together in class and we kind of started processing through it as a class, one of, you know, many of the students kind of re-resonated with this book that I'm sure some of you have read, Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. It's very accessible. It's kind of like it's become required reading in our department because it tells a very simple story, and it's about a very accomplished journalist now rewriting a story to his son and trying to communicate to him his experiences of growing up as a black man in America and what that means for his son, even though his son is going to be growing up in a much more privileged situation than he was. And what Coates really brings to light in that writing is that if you're a minority and a person of color in this country, specifically if you're from the black community, then everything you do is from a position, from an existential condition of fear. That fear conditions your life in almost every way, down to deciding as a child which route to take to school. And he uses that to kind of show that it's always there and it's always present, so that he and this is his way of reading, you know, black culture, but he says, even in the hip hop and even in the girls on the corner and the boys talking tough, it's all done out of fear. That's actually the motivating platform that you have to build yourself up, because there's always this fear there. And that fear just has such real effects on people's lives. You know, I came from Arizona, and I remember in 2010 when we passed the SB 1070 laws, which kind of known as the Show Me Your Papers laws, you know, there was those on the right who said, well, if you're legitimate and you've got papers, and or if you're a citizen, even if you're pulled over and, you know, legally profiled now, it's no big deal. But they really missed the point. I mean, they missed the point in so many ways. But there's a disconnect there in not understanding what it is to wear a skin, a color, be in a body that is constantly being surveyed, where your mere presence is inviting state surveillance and perhaps more harsh policing tactics. And so I just think that that's something that isn't talked about enough, in the sense that by only focusing on the acts of violence that, you know, after the election, people said, well, they started recording, well, there's been swastikas painted here and this and that, and then that's kind of died down. And it's like, oh, we're kind of returning to a normal. Like, no, that wasn't the violence that I really sensed was being felt within the communities that I deal with. The violence was immediate. The violence was a return of the fear. For people who are here on DACA, the thought that that could be erased with a signature, it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. And that's something that's very difficult to know how to even talk students through or friends through when they come to you and they just say, I'm just scared. That's it. I'm just scared. And it doesn't matter if they can list off policies or laws or all these rationale for it. It's that fear that they can't shake that's going to condition and structure every moment of their life. And it's not acceptable that at this time in history, we ask half of our population to live in fear of those kinds of things.
Absolutely. In the next hour, one of the panelists will be, I like the way she puts it, a documented student. So we will talk about that. Chief Peterson, speaking of which, how is the university preparing for this upcoming administration with DACA students, with the fear of immigration raiding nationwide, basically? What is the university doing with the police department?
Well, I think probably the thing that would be most effective is to read Chancellor White's words. And he basically stated our position in three very declarative sentences, and those are, the CSU will not enter into agreements with state or local law enforcement agencies, Homeland Security, or any other federal department for the enforcement of federal immigration law. Our university police departments, including University Police Department here at UPD, Humboldt State University, will not honor immigration hold requests. And our university police do not contact, detain, question, or arrest individuals solely on the basis of being or suspected of being a person that lacks documentation. I happen to also be the president of the Law Enforcement Association of Humboldt County, the Chiefs Association. And in conversation with my counterparts, the sheriff, the local area commander for CHP, the Arcata Police Department, the Eureka Police Department, we're all unified in this basic concept that we will not, do not, cannot operate under anything other than these guidelines. So we look at people as Chancellor White does.
I'm sure our campus is more than happy, ecstatic to hear that. There may be a small population that may not be, but I'm guessing the people in this room and the people listening are in agreement and happy that is taking place. And hopefully, this will become a sanctuary state for the state of California.
If I could, too, it just spoke earlier about the NAACP, much on a national level. We've recently elected a new president here at our local level, and Liz Smith is dedicated to the cause of justice, and I'd like to invite anybody who might be hearing my voice right now to look into getting involved in our local branch. I think it's a great way to get involved at a local level that'll have a national impact.
Full disclosure, I am the social media person for the local branch of the NAACP, and I can say the September meeting, it was a regular same old eight people. The November meeting, it was probably 15 people. The December meeting, it was probably 30 people. And actually, Chief Peterson is our incoming vice president of that NAACP as well. But we saw the support of the NAACP in our own community on Monday. Yeah. The Eureka Police Chief invited the community to march in solidarity with the NAACP in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. He said himself he was expecting maybe 30 people, maybe 40 people, but 500 plus people were there in support. And during that march and the subsequent celebration at the Dorney Center, applications for membership, we ran out of them. Yeah. So we don't have, do we have applications here?
No, I didn't bring any, but I'm happy to talk to anybody joining ZZ, you know, $30 a year.
You can do that. I don't think I can solicit in this capacity right now, but thank you for saying that. That was subtle. So Tay, you are the Student Engagement and Leadership Dean or Associate Dean here at Humboldt State. What has the buzz been around with students since the election of November 8th? What have you seen? What have you felt? What have you experienced since that day?
Wow. It feels like it was so long ago. Was anyone else with me on that? But it really wasn't, right? You know, I think right after the elections, there was a real active buzz, I think, on campus in terms of, in my experience, a lot of students feeling a lot like you described earlier in terms of your birthday and just really having high hopes of what was going to happen and not necessarily getting the outcome they expected. And I think part of that it's because maybe many students felt the way that I did in terms of I thought we were at a certain place. And so in my mind, I thought, oh, that'll never happen. You know, not with all the very public things he keeps saying, you know. And so I think a lot of students were in shock the day after, just not fully understanding what that mean, replaying in their mind all the press conferences and interviews and presidential debates that happened and what was said and, you know, are any of those things going to come to fruition? And if they do, how is that going to impact me? And how is that going to impact the people around me and the people that I care for? And, you know, I think the campus in a lot of ways showed up for the students, but also for each other. Like, you know, we're faculty, staff, administrators, but we're human. You know, you don't cut off your whole personal life as soon as your car hits the circle drive at the library, right? Like, you bring that with you everywhere that you go, and I can't be two Tays. I'm just me. And so being able to navigate how the students are feeling and supporting them, and I don't just mean the students who are upset. I mean the students who full out support this new administration. And as a faculty staff administrator, your job is to support all students. And being able to navigate that and navigate how you personally feel is very difficult. And I've been in higher ed for a long time. Well, I feel like it's a long time. But I mean, I started young, and it feels like it's been a long time. This is the first time that I feel like I failed at that. I absolutely found it impossible to come to campus and not, and to cut off thinking about, as a single mom, how this new administration is going to impact me financially. I am still afraid, you know, to the point where I'm now thinking about side hustles. You know, what side job can I get? Because this is going to impact my taxes. This is going to impact, you know, I really felt strongly that this new administration hates women. And more than hate women, they hate single moms. It's almost like we're being punished for being a single mother. And so a lot of what people don't understand about some of the tax laws that they're going to try to pass is going to really impact many of us. Yeah. Many of the people who voted for this administration don't even understand that they voted against their own best interest. Mm.
They will and soon so, enough.
And you know, I feel that's sad. And part of what we did today, we went over a speech that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, Dr. King's Drum Major Instinct speech, and we talked about our sermon, and we talked about that sermon, and we talked about how he defined the drum major instinct, that need to be out front, to be better than, to be superior than. And, you know, people look at when you can't do it financially, you do it in other ways. And so it becomes very surface things. My car is better than yours. My house is bigger. I make more money. My kids dress better. I can afford to put Jordans on my kid, and you can't. And then when you don't have that, you rely on even more superficial things like color. Mm-hmm. Well, I may not have all those things, but I'm whiter than you. Mm. And we know that in America, that means something. And we've allowed it to mean something over decades, when in actuality, we know it means nothing. And one of the things that Dr. King talked about, and if we really think about it, the people of color who were searching for and demanding their civil rights, poor white people should have been right along with them, because they were also being dehumanized and treated badly, and allowing the people who are, you know, this small percentage of people who are making the money to stay at that level and stay on top, and using something like superficial race and skin color to keep us separated. Because if that wasn't introduced, we would all be working together because we feel like we deserve better. So for me, when you have the haves and the have-nots, you're always going to have racism.
Absolutely.
Until we address why there's this percentage of people who are, you know, have tax laws and their benefit and they're making more and more and more and don't want to give back at all, as if they didn't benefit from anybody else, we are always going to have racism, because someone in that group is always going to only have skin color. That is the only thing they're going to feel they have to be superior than someone else. And that's sad. But one of the things I will say positive about our students, man, are they resilient. Because regardless of how they were feeling, they still showed up. They still went to class. They still did their work. They still do programs cross campus to benefit their fellow students. And I am very impressed and proud of them for supporting one another and being there for one another. So I know you can't shamelessly plug, but I'm going to shamelessly plug our HSU Day of Solidarity, which is tomorrow. And as I've said to many people, you know, the purpose of that day, and I'm speaking on behalf of the coordinator, so hopefully I don't get this wrong. The purpose of the day is not to make anyone feel bad that they voted for this administration. It's to show support for the people who are living in fear. To show them that, you know, when you see Chief Peterson across campus, he is someone you can stop and talk to and say, this is how I feel. This is how I'm feeling right now. And his involvement is a way to show you, I see you. Yes. Not only do I see you, I hear you. And so we're hoping people turn out for that reason, if nothing else, to show your fellow student, faculty, staff, community member, I hear you and I see you.
Absolutely.
And I need to be heard and seen. And so that is happening tomorrow, and that's one way the HSU has showed up and showed out.
And we'll get more information about that in the next hour. I think Jessica has a question.
Well, we have a listener from Eureka who's loving the town hall and everything that people are talking about and would like to add to what you were saying, Tay, about how we can locally be vigilant and show others our support. So any other ideas folks have about locally what we can do?
And be mindful, we have about 4 minutes for the next 4 minutes before we take a break, and we'll play a little music and switch out. So keep your comments brief for this next part.
Yeah, and Jeff Blank with the NAACP is, yeah, join the local branch of the NAACP, and there are local branches of other organizations here that are doing good things. I know the feeling was I have to create something new now to deal with this, and it's like, unfortunately, no, this has been going on. These things have been going on, as Tay said, for decades. And now what it is there's a resurgent, and it's kind of like, you know, it's a big swing that we don't want to have happen. So look for your local organizations. A lot of them have websites. You can figure out what they're doing and join, and you're going to need to get active because, as Donald Trump has said, you know, he's coming for the Muslims. It goes, who's next? You know, and you look around the room and it's like, you know, people of color, Jews, whoever, and there's a rise of that attitude, and then we have to stop it.
Absolutely. I'd like to thank all of the guests in the first from this first hour. Jeff Blank from the Eureka branch of the NAACP, Chief Don Peterson from Humboldt State University Police Department, Dr. Clark Sagada, Criminology and Justice Studies at Humboldt State, Tanza Trey Tiggs, Associate Dean of Student Engagement and Leadership at HSU, Dr. Lauren Cannon, Philosophy Department at HSU, and Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy, Native American Studies Department at HSU. Again, the numbers to call if you are interested in joining in this conversation, and there is someone in the studio taking your calls, and then we will transcribe them and read them here live in the Kate Buchanan room. That number is 707-826-4805. If you're outside of the listening area, you can dial 800-640-5911 or text your question directly to 707-492-5478. And one more thing. We are on Facebook Live right now, and thank you to our sound and social media engineer, Mike Dronkers, for making that happen. I think you have another question.
I was just wondering if we had any questions here that we could slip in before the hour closes with these particular panelists.
Thank you. I have a question for the chief. I really appreciated everything that you had to say, and especially the fact that you're working with the other chiefs in the county. I imagine that you are also talking with the other chiefs about the what-ifs. The what-ifs of possible federalization of any of the police forces, about the mobilization of National Guard, anything like that. Have you thought or talked about that at all?
That's being talked about at a lot of levels, and I think we're fortunate to live in the state of California. Just this evening before I came here, they had legislators that were speaking about what they're going to be doing. The state of California hired a former Attorney General, Eric Holder, as a watchdog, frankly, to keep an eye on things and make sure things do not slip and get out of hand. And I think California is going to take on a huge leadership role. And we talk about the population of the state and what that represents in terms of economics. And we have a very, very loud voice. And I can speak candidly. None of those things that you talked about are going to happen here on this campus. Not on my watch, not on Dr. Rossbacher's watch. It's just not something that we would ever allow to happen.
Thank you. I'm going to turn it over to our in-studio engineer, Michael Roccaforte. We're going to play a little bit of music and give the panelists a time to swap out with the upcoming panelists in the next hour. Thank you for joining us.